Welcome back. I'm now here playing Mr. Technology, helping Trisha Ricketts figure out how to use the headphones. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Well, that's good, because that's step one in an interview process. What did you think? I'm so glad you and Peter, your boy, were here to hear Nestor. What did you think of him?
Oh, I thought he was fascinating.
Yeah, and he's inspiring, don't you
think? He is, and the telling of the immigrant stories, especially from all over the world, and given the political environment all over the world, and here, you know, the push-me-pull-you kind of feelings about that, I thought it was especially fascinating.
Well, you will be, too, because your novel, A Speed of Dark, is a fascinating novel. I want to get a lot of your background. You're going to be on all the way till 6:30. Because one of the characters in your novel is Lake Michigan. I'm leaving it at that. One of the characters, ladies and gentlemen, in Trisha's novel, Speed of Dark, and her byline is Patricia Rickards, but I'll call her Trisha, is a lake. It is that lake that sits right out there that you can see out there. You didn't say hello when you
walked
in.
Well, we're looking right out. The vista here is Michigami, which
well,
is
one of
my
the things
character.
That I enjoyed everything about your book. One of the things I enjoyed tremendously was it's an ambitious book. It is it is not just, I'm going to tell a story about, in much like the same way Nestor is a storyteller. You are a born storyteller. How did that happen? Like a lot of people, I've read a couple things about you, and you wrote poems and stories as a kid.
Yeah.
Everybody wrote poems and stories as a kid.
Well, I think that's true, but I come from a family, my dad was, one, hilariously funny. He was a people person, and he could tell a joke like nobody's business. And as a matter of fact, I've told this story that he wasn't necessarily a very good golfer, but he was passionate about it. But he was also fun.
Wait a minute, like most golfers,
Amen. So, but people wanted to play with him because he just made it so much fun, and he would tell stories on there. And he really was, I mean, people would kind of hang on his every word and listen to the stories he would tell about his growing up in Chicago as a young boy and being one step ahead of the rent collector kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the concept of telling a story with a setup, kind of a punchline, and the ending is perhaps built into me.
Wow, interesting. Some genetic thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Where'd you grow up in Chicago?
Actually, we grew up in Evanston.
Okay.
And lived there until we moved for 2 years. We lived out in Glenview, Illinois, and then we moved to Glencoe. So it was always the northern suburbs.
And your dad was in, I mean, I think there are a lot of WGN listeners who will all of a sudden go, oh my, when you mention the restaurants that your family owned, they'll go, oh my God, I love that place.
Yeah.
Your family was in the restaurant business.
They were, indeed. And actually, the restaurant business goes back to 1898, when my great-grandmother...
Really? Wow.
Yes. She received insurance money from the death of her husband, Hugh Ricketts, who was a riverboat captain, I think on the Illinois River.
Mm.
And when he died, she used that money to set herself up in a tea room, and they were popular in that day.
Yeah.
And then she made money. So she had three sons, and she set each of her sons up in a restaurant. They all called them Ricketts. They weren't really a chain. They were individually owned. One was at Chicago Avenue at Michigan Avenue.
That's the one I remember.
Yeah. It
distinctly.
It was part of the Toddlin' Tot.
Sure.
Truly.
Sure.
And then my dad's father had one at Clark and DeVercy,
mm-hmm.
which was, all of the after hours, Mort Saul, Bob Hope, Danny Thomas.
Nightclub guys.
Yeah, they would all go there. And a little story here.
Sure.
The guys who were actually assassinated in the Clark Street killing there, they had breakfast.
I mean, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Thank you.
I
was like
Clark
searching
Street
for
killing.
That word.
I
want to
change the name of the
you
St.
Got
Valentine's
it. No,
Day
I'm not going to change it. St. Valentine's Day
Clark
Massacre.
Clark Street killing.
They had breakfast that day at our Clark and Diversity restaurant.
Wow.
And so the celebs came there, and it was open 24/7.
Ah, the good old days.
Yeah. And so.
Did you, as a young girl, hang out? Were you at the restaurant? And this is not the Ricketts family that is that has destroyed the Cubs, to my mind. That's another Ricketts family.
No, we were here first.
Yeah. Did you have a sense? I mean, running a restaurant can be a flamboyant kind of business.
Well, it is and was.
Yeah.
And so when we were young and my dad had the restaurant at Clark and DeVersey, we didn't work there. We would just come as a family, and there were six of us in the family. And so they would put us in the farthest back room because we were pretty rowdy, I guess. But so we were there mostly for dinner. But then, this is back like in the 60s, the restaurant business in this particular place started to tank, and it was supporting two families, my dad and his brother.
Oh, wow.
So Uncle John bought out my dad, and he then bought Ricketts Restaurant in Wheeling, Illinois, on the Chevy Chase Country Club site. It was a roadhouse. It was adorable and darling. And so we all worked there, every one of us.
Mm.
And yeah, we were dishwashers and salad girls.
So as a suburban high school girl, you were talking back to your writing. You wrote short stories. You wrote for English class. You wrote. I'm always curious about the seeds of someone who can write a novel as accomplished as, and you'll get to hear how accomplished The Speed of Dark is during this segment. I'm always fascinated with what starts a writer's career.
I guess I could say I'm not sure, except even in grade school I would write stories about my life and loves.
Wow.
Which is, I think, hilarious.
What kind of loves did you have in grade school?
Oh, crushes galore. And so anyway, I would sit in the kitchen on a stool as my mother would be chopping carrots or stirring gravy or doing whatever. I, by the way, never working or rarely working, but I would read these little stories to my mother, and I could tell from the hunch in her back that she was listening and approving.
Wow.
And it was really kind of a very subtle, indirect support, if you will.
Did any of your five siblings write that you knew of, or maybe they were just hiding their stories from you?
Not really. But I always wrote. And then when I went to college, I thought I was going to be a biology major.
Where'd you go to college?
University of Illinois in Urbana. Yeah. And but I hit chemistry. Now, I am not a numbers person.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, I've got to get out of this. And I thought, well, what do I like to do? I like to read and I like to write.
Got to get out of this.
Yeah. Got to get out of that one. So I did. And I became an English major. And then I fell into teaching. It was an accident.
That happens. That happens to a lot of English majors.
And so for most of my 30-year teaching career, I actually taught kids to analyze the writing and the style.
Did you teach high school, grammar school, college?
I did. Well, I started off grade school, but I went then after that into the high school level. And I had mostly, thank God, it was really a gift, I had the upper-level kids who would come into the classroom with their forks in the air and say, when do we eat?
Yeah, right.
True. We talked things like word choice and cadence and tempo and sentence structure and how that impacts the emotional reaction of the reader. And so, you know, it became inculcated into me.
Yeah.
And
so in a sense, you were teaching yourself too, yes?
Without realizing. And I actually wrote my first novel when my personal children were little and they napped. So I wrote every day during nap time. I had 2 hours, 1 to 3, pretty much. And it took me a year. And this is on an old-fashioned Smith Corona, and it wasn't even electric. And it took me a year to write a draft. And then I refined and refined and refined, and I did get an agent back in the day from that, but she said, oh, this needs a whole lot of editing. Well, I went through some life changes and a couple of moves, and there was no computer, so I had it wasn't saved except in a hard copy. I think I had two or three.
Yeah.
Got lost in the move.
Oh my gosh, like Hemingway's famous short stories, Getting Lost on the Train.
I have read that one, by the way.
Yeah.
So, but you know what? That was okay. It taught me how to get a reader to turn the page. And the arc of even of a chapter within a novel.
Where were you teaching? Were you still in the Chicago area?
I started at a Catholic grade school in Winnetka, Sacred Heart. It was my first.
Know it well.
Then I moved to Kansas City, and I taught in the Blue Valley School District. Very nice school district. And then when I moved back to the Chicago area, I taught at Maine South High School.
Oh, sure.
A fine school.
Sure, yeah. Was there a marriage and some children involved in this moving back and forth thing?
I'm sorry.
For you. Was there a marriage or children? Why'd you move?
There was the loss of a marriage involved.
Okay.
And that, so I came back, I guess you could say, home, much to the chagrin, I think, of my own personal children, but I did. But I get down to see them. They're still there, and I see them about every...
Well, then you got serious about it, and you got a scholarship, didn't you?
I did, and it was something that you applied for.
Right.
If you were teaching Shakespearean classes, and so I had had a friend who had actually gotten it maybe 3 or 4 years prior, so I went ahead and I applied, and by golly, I got it. And so once you were there, it was the University of Edinburgh. It was a 3-week summer creative writing program. It happened to be at the same time as Fringe and the International Book Festival.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was so alive there. And we had writers from all over the UK who would come and speak and do their poetry readings. And it was a real shot in the arm.
And that's what really reignited your passion and energy for writing.
It did.
It turned itself that... that manifested itself in the short stories, which I do want to read some of your short stories. I have not. I've only read Speed of Dark, which is a fascinating book. It is also very kind of Chicago-centric. There's no doubt about that.
It is.
I literally feel like one of her characters is looking over my shoulder. That character, being Lake Michigan, will continue this conversation after some news. Trish Ricketts' novel, Speed of Dark, begins with a African-American man traveling to Northbrook, right? Northbrook, and
yes,
knocking on a door and initiating a compelling story. But within 30 pages, a new character comes into the story. I'm going to read you a paragraph of what this new character has to say in the book, and there's no contest involved. Talk to yourself, talk amongst yourselves or your loved ones, and tell me who this is. Some humans say I am unpredictable, given to sudden volatility interrupted by bouts of gloom. They would be correct. Others say I am whimsical, that caprice skips along my edges, sings on the crests of my waves, thrills at the variation of my hues. They would be correct, too. Still others say I am stable, a vast and wide expanse providing power for their use and rumination for their overwrought souls. Ah, yes, they would also be correct. That is Lake Michigan narrating. It is one of the three narrators of this. That's a bold leap, I think, Tricia, but you pull it off.
Well, I guess...
Thanks, Rick. Well, thanks a lot.
I guess I did pull it off. It came as a kind of inspiration, truly. I knew that there was going to be a climactic moment that would happen at Lake Michigan. And it kind of evolved into, well, I believe strongly in the ecology of the planet, that we need to take care of it. And I thought... Mary M., the female character, Mosley, the black male character, they all have a grief and a worry that they are dealing with. And I thought, well, so does Lake Michigan, and whose name in the book is Michigami, which is the Ojibwe name for the great water. And so it just made sense to me to come at redemption from grief, healing from deep sorrow, that I could bring them together.
In a sense. I mean, I think you pull it off remarkably well. I think I hate to always say, ooh, there are three big main issues in the book, but I don't think they're issues as much as they are themes.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the planet, the health of this planet as exemplified by the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Another is race and race relations.
Yes.
And another is sort of the struggle for redemption from grief.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are those...
Yeah. Okay. I would say that is very
different. If I were an English teacher, that would be a good interpretation.
Yes, and I would give you an A+ for finding them.
Well, the woman, one of the fascinating things is in a sense, the lake is, I'm going to say the lake is evil. This is anthropomorphic, this is going nuts, but it kind of is, in a sense, wooing main female character.
I think he's both seductive and threatening.
Good point.
And I think it's kind of true about the action of a large body of water. It seductive. We swim in it. We dive in it. We love it. We drink its water. We water our gardens from it. But it's threatening.
What is this black man, Mr. Mosley Albright, what does he want when he knocks on that door?
Well, I would have to say I think he's my favorite character in
a
way.
He's a good character.
And I think he's a beautiful, deeply spiritual man. And he's arrived there fairly early in the book. He has had a near-death experience, and I have a sister who actually had a near-death experience. And she talked about the light that you read about in Helen Kubler-Ross's writings. And so I thought this would have been a profound impact on anyone. So I went ahead and put that in there to explain why this wonderful man can kind of look into the eyes of people, see their sorrows, see their fears, and help them along. But Peter and I have recently... I'd say in the last 6 years, become friends with many musicians in the blues world. Mm-hmm. And so I have come to love especially a couple of people. And this Mosley is kind of an amalgamation of those people who have made an impact on me.
Mary M. Phillips, M for Margaret, right?
It's Margaret,
for Margaret,
yes.
Right, but E-M. She's had some troubles. She has some losses.
Deep, yes, deep losses.
Who did she lose?
She lost, I guess, not that it's insignificant, but she has lost her grandmother who raised her. But in her past, maybe 30 years prior,
right.
She lost her mother, and her father died early. I don't really explain much about him. So she has lost her Mamie, which is what she calls her, who raised her. She has also lost her husband, Jack, through divorce.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps most profound...
Her son.
Her son.
Yeah.
Her beloved and only son. And there's guilt attached to a decision she made. And I think that it is true in our lives that sometimes you can make a cavalier decision that could have profound consequences.
It's fabulous. You're getting a real sense of it. I don't want Patricia, to give away too much.
No.
I don't, because I think, the narrative drive is very, very strong. And but we will, after a short break, come back and talk about some of the, one of the haunting chapters is titled Michigami Meets Jack.
Yes.
We'll talk about that chapter and some other items in... My friend Maury Posley has just walked in here. He's on at 6:30. I can't wait to talk to him. We have a lot of catching up to do. So stay tuned. Welcome back. My friend Maury Posley's in here. He'll be on the air at 6:30, and we'll reminisce about the many adventures we've had in our lives. Tricia Ricketts is here for a few more minutes talking about her complex but not challenging. I don't think this book is challenging. I think it has a real strong narrative drive.
Good. Thank
it
you.
Hits a lot of Chicago places,
oh,
Tricia.
Yes.
Oh, of course, that's purposeful because it's part of your life, right?
It is, and it has been.
So tell me some of the places it hits. I mean, it goes to the aquarium, it goes to the park, it's downtown, it's all over the place.
It is. Well, there's a train ride, which is kind of Odyssey-like, if you will, on the Metra.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing. And she travels from the northern suburbs, and there's this transition from the orderliness of a suburban lawn or backyard into the cacophony, if you will, of streets and back alleys and dumpsters as she gets into the city. So that, if anyone's ever taken the train and done that track, they understand that that's part of it. And then when she gets off, she's at Union Station. And then, actually, yes, it is Union. And then she walks Adams and meets people along the street, street people, if you will. And I think they're kind of interesting and fun. And she goes under the L and goes by I can't think of the architect, Mies van der Rohe.
Yeah.
That she goes by there. There's a kind of a protest taking place. And she ends up at the Art Institute, and which is a holy mecca for me, certainly.
Sure. Sure.
And it's for many people. And so I even talk about the staircase and some of the Louis Sullivan Grill and some of the paintings that are within. And there's some iconic touch points, if you will, I think.
But you can also sense your joy in this thing as it revolves. We talked about that one chapter that really is kind of haunting. Hold on, let me find it. It's a lot of this, and I read you a portion of it about the lake and where the lake meets Jack.
Oh, yes.
What happens there?
Well, as we said, the lake is rather seductive of...
And dangerous, though.
And dangerous. He can be kind of threatening.
Like most seductive,
but he calls
things,
Miriam his Nibinabe,
uh-huh.
which is Ojibwe for spirit of the water. And he thinks she is going to be able to save him. So when he sees her with Jack, who is at that point her husband, he brings about some trouble
mm-hmm.
for Miriam and hoping to ruin Jack, but I don't want to go too much
into it.
I think it's an interesting...
Yeah, it's a tough book to talk about because you don't want to give too much away.
Yeah.
I mean, are you pleased with this? What was the process of writing this like for you?
You mean actual writing?
Yes.
When the pandemic came, as I said, I had been kind of noodling around with it for a few years, maybe 4 years. And then I thought, you know, this pandemic is horrific, but it's a gift. And to be sequestered in your home, to be forced to do, you know, jigsaw puzzles and finish your novel, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right.
And so I went ahead and put my nose to the grindstone and did it.
And did it pour out with joy? And there's some tough things in this book.
There are, but... I love writing, and so the writing of it, I feel like, I don't know if you know Annie Lamott, but in her book,
sure.
Bird by Bird, she says, you have to have shitty first drafts and allow them to live. And then, so when you write, if you say, oh, I don't care if it's bad because I can always come back in and fix it, it's kind of like, on the imaginative side, letting your children out to play in a playground. They're dancing all over the place, and they may not be orderly.
And then walking away.
Well, but knowing that you can eventually put them in ranks and bring them into that classroom.
These are people in the book who are, all of them, I think, struggling to survive in a world that is somehow inhospitable. But I still find the book kind of hopeful. Am
yes.
I wrong? I would have been a good English teacher.
I think it's tremendously hopeful.
Yeah.
I think one big piece, maybe we could use the word theme, in the book is faith. And it's not about faith in a religion or faith in a God, but it's faith that there is goodness in the world. And it's kind of one of the reasons the book is set, most of it, the real time of the book is set on the vernal equinox, because this is when the planet struggles between light and dark. And there's an epilogue which actually ends right near the solstice.
Right.
Which things have turned to the light. And many, many of these characters, whether they're down and out or they're on top of their game, although I'm hard pressed to find one of those actually off the top of my head.
Yeah, I would do.
But her grandma Mamie.
Okay.
Might be on the top of her head.
She's long gone, but go ahead.
Yes, but there's great faith. And I think there's a little character called Nonna Cacchetto, which is a little Italian crone. She's all about faith. You said you'd be there? You're there.
And you did. In order to write this, I have to assume you did a lot of research.
I did.
Was that rewarding for you? It shows in the book, because the stuff you don't feel like you're being lectured to about the, you know, the certain tribes that once lived on the banks of Lake Michigan.
Right. No, it was fun. I like to research. I don't like it to be an assignment per se, but if I'm writing about something, like I had to look up a lot about Lake Michigan, and I had this wonderful book written by John and Mary Mahan, M-A-H-A-N, called The Wild Lake Michigan. Mm. And I'm sure it's out of print now, but we found it in a rare bookstore. It was just a treasure trove of information about the gradation of beach growth, and that there are three layers of beaches, for example. And I didn't know, for example, that this Lake Michigan in its present state has only been like this for 14,000 years. I assumed it went way, 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 way back.
14 million years, yeah.
Sure. And so, but finding all that, then the Eastland tragedy, right below us here. I had heard about it maybe, but I really researched it and pulled it into the... So there's a lot of information about the lake, about the Ojibwe.
When you had to give this book to your publisher, the She Writes Press, was it difficult?
I had decided that at this stage in my life, I didn't have time to shop it around.
Yeah.
You know, and look, for, who's going to take a debut author at this stage in the game? They don't want to take a risk on me, I didn't think.
Well, they did it famously on Norman McLean, who was a famous teacher at the University of Chicago, who wrote one of my friend Maury Posley's favorite books, A River Runs Through It.
I know it well.
It happens, but you were satisfied and you said, all right, this is my first novel out there, and I'm on to my second.
I think it's it was a matter of time.
Yeah.
And how much time I felt that I had, and I wanted to get it out there, because in a way, I feel that this book is my gift with things I feel very profoundly about.
Well, you do an amazing job, Tricia.
Oh,
we met at some party. Your guy, Peter Hurley, introduced you to me. I've known Peter for a long time, and I'm... you challenge yourself. This is no Dick and Jane book, but it's fascinating on every level.
It was a joy to write, I have to say.
Well, it's big themes, and you're a terrific writer. You're very
thank you
polished,
so much.
Polished writer. You have a next book in you, do you?
Yeah, the next one is tentatively titled The 1st of June, and I've set it in the pandemic because I think, oh my gosh, there's... such rich, which like an auger plate full of bacteria. I mean, we've got a lot going on with this pandemic thing besides just the coronavirus. And I think I'm going to bring in the idea of the proliferation of guns.
I'll be reading it. Thank you. And Peter, thank you, too,
thank you for having me, Rick.
My pleasure. My pleasure.